You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Well, financial insanity, societal insanity, global. It's not a global pandemic. It is a global insanity pandemic. And especially when it comes to how the hell do you get through this thing alive? Well, somebody who's been writing about this for years, saw it coming a good 20 plus years ago. Our good friend Daryl Shoon is with us now, drshoon.com. That's where you find him. So, Daryl, what's the latest development here in insanity, and how do you fight it?
Well, you know, Kerry, in 2007, I wrote a book, and my articles about the book brought me to the public's attention. Okay, and it was called "The Time of the Vulture," and In my book, I predicted a economic collapse was imminent. Now, this is 2007. The property bubble was only beginning to deflate. The air hadn't gone out of it. Nothing had really happened. And in that time, I predicted we were about to go into the shitter, into the toilet. But it was based upon these words that I had heard in 1991, Kerry, it said, in times of expansion, it is to the hare the prize goes. Quick, risk-taking, and bold, his qualities are exactly suited to the times. In times of contraction, however, it is to the tortoise the prize goes. Quick to only retract his vulnerable head and neck, his is the slow and sure is preferable in times instead of being quick and easy. Every once in a while, however, there comes a time when neither the hare nor the tortoise is the victor. This is when the pastures of the bull lay buried beneath the rubble of economic collapse. And the bears under the collapse. It says, this is the time of the vulture. And the vulture feeds neither upon the stored up wealth of the bear or the pastures of the bull. The vulture instead feeds upon the blind denial and ignorance of the ostrich. All right. Those words came to me in 1991, Kerry. I had never taken an econ course in my life. Everything looked copacetic at the time. There was no sign of an economic collapse. You know, there's a slight contraction in the real estate market at the time, which is always going up and down. But other than that, there was nothing really big. But the words, they came from out of the blue, and they riveted me. And that's when I started studying economics. That's when I started looking to the Great Depression again, other than just a layman's view of it. That's when I started studying the nature of money and banking and gold and silver. All right. And it all started making sense. Well, when I wrote my book in 2007, which was 16 years later, I knew what was going to happen because I had done enough studying at the time to see it. But what I want to say now is this. It was titled Time of the Vulture, and it came out in 2007, but it predicted a certain event. Kerry, that event is happening now. Okay. And I want to put it in the context of Austrian economics, all right, of Ludwig von Mises. In 1949, von Mises wrote an extraordinary book called Human Action. Very few people have, Kerry.
I know. Oft quoted, least read, right?
Yes. That's very good. Oft quoted, least read. That's excellent. And what he had done was because people tend to look at markets as some sort of objective reality. Like, it goes on with this factor, this factor. And basically, von Mises said it's a result of human nature in a way. All right. And what he talked about, though, within that context was he had something called a crack-up boom. All right. And he said, if credit creation is allowed to continue without halt, it will ultimately finally culminate in what he calls a crack-up boom, a boom in which valuations skyrocket. All right. But they're doing so because it's the final blow off of excessive credit creation. Now, what we're seeing now is the crack-up boom. And my belief is it was triggered by the enormous amount of monetary creation in 2020 because of COVID. All right? When 2020 happened, basically economies across the world contracted between 40 and 50%, with an average, I think, 45% contraction. That's huge. I mean, Carrie, that's like driving your Tesla that you just bought at 120 miles an hour, all right? But you don't put on the brakes. You fucking, I mean, you'll slow down. You hit that brake so hard, but you've got Tesla brakes. So your wheels are smoking, all right?
And doing that through Times Square. Driving that way through Times Square in New York City.
Okay. And within a month, your Tesla, instead of going 120, you're now going at 40. All right. Within a short period of time, you've gone from 120 to 140. Well, economically, in credit-based culture, in credit-based economies, you need the economy, you need to be going faster and faster and faster. Why? This is why the obsession is with growth. Because it's based upon debt-based money, all right? And debt-based money, your debts are always increasing. When money is released into the economy, the time that it's like it starts ticking, all right? And unless the economy grows faster than that clock is ticking, you're going to go bankrupt. Either you individually, the government. The government goes bankrupt last because it's printing the money, all right? In front of the government is you, me, corporations, everybody. But the government is last because they get to print the money. But what happens, and this is what von Mises said, when the crack-up boom ends, the flight into real values begins, which is gold and silver, mm-hmm. and the monetary system falters. Now, why? Because the debts can no longer be repaid. And if money is a function of debt and debts can't be repaid, money basically disappears. This is what happened during the Great Depression, Gary. One of my questions, because I went into this naked, you know, my background was political science, you know, blah, 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 blah. I never took an econ course in my life. The idea of taking an econ course was like, what the heck? You know, I didn't like college to begin with. And at least I was going to spend my time being interested in something. And it wasn't a apparently dry thing on economics. I didn't know how fascinating economics really was, but not the way it was taught. And after I heard those words, one of my early questions, Kerry, was, what happened to all the money during the Great Depression? Because it disappeared. It disappeared. I mean,
bank runs.
Yeah, what happened? Yeah. What I realized, Kerry, what my insight was after the Federal Reserve took control of the money supply, money was no longer a thing of value that was stable. It wasn't a gold coin. It wasn't a silver coin. It wasn't even a copper penny or a silver dime. It was a piece of paper that represented credit, represented debt in a credit-based economy. And what happened is when debt overtakes credit, that money can't be repaid back and it disappears off the ledger. We've all heard it said, if all debts were repaid, money would disappear. That's why. Because in capitalist society, capital is debt-based money. It's not money anymore.
Debt-based currency.
It's debt-based currency. And when debts if all debts got repaid, money would disappear. Well, the flip side of that saying is, when debts can't be repaid, it also disappears. Now, what happened is that the boys at the top, I mean, we could bitch at them all we want because they're not doing what we wanted to do. The truth is they don't serve us. The truth is it's a canard saying that they were put up to stop financial collapses. You know, that was the first excuse. And that became they're there to protect employment. They're bullshit. They're there to protect the bankers who are making bank off of everybody's debt and the politicians who are living off of it. And that's why they're there. Now, one thing you can notice about these boys, they're not stupid. They're some of the smartest motherfuckers on the planet, and they're privy to a lot more data than you and I have. But as it says, when you're working for the devil, you can't say he's the devil. And Greenspan was a lot more honest before and after he was chairman of the Fed. Before he became chairman of the Fed, Greenspan was a gold bug. All right? He knew about it. All right? Then you put him in as chairman of the Fed, and all of a sudden he's going, well, it's not the purpose of the Fed to prick bubbles with monetary means. It's very hard to tell if a bubble's happening. Okay? Then when he finally left, well, I think we got a bubble going in real estate. All right. He was able to see a bubble in real estate like he was unable to see a bubble in the .com. Why? The only thing that changed was his employer.
Yep. That's it. Hey, so the crack up boom, the debt-based currency, all these things. One thing, you know, we've talked about Austrian economics so many times. What I haven't heard mentioned by anyone, probably in 10 years, is the beneficiary of all that fresh money. It's the banks, because they get it before it takes the inflationary hit.
Oh, the banks get, and this is what led me to Anton Fekete, you know, my sort of mentor.
Of course, yeah.
I can't call my mentor because I was too stupid to understand really everything he talked about. He was so brilliant, but I could understand his insights. And the first article I read, which is in the late 1990s, is on GoldEagle.com. Here's this guy I'd never heard of him before. This name that made no sense to me, all right? And he said, in a severe economic downturn, the central banks will lower the rates to as low as they can to restart the economy. He said, that money will never get in the economy. Then that money will be taken by the banks, reinvested in an arbitrage in treasuries or any other thing that they have a spread, and they'll make their money. And the only people, and he was right. I was stunned when I read that. I thought, nobody's saying that. This is before, this is 1999. This is before the bubble started popping here. But I knew he was right. And what happens is, not only do the banks get it, and their cohorts, the investment funds, there's no difference between the U.S. Federal Reserve and there's no real difference between Jamie Dimon and Jerome Powell at this moment, except their particular venue. All right, because each one is working at the behest of others. All right, and they're doing it there. It's because all the investment banks around the world get it free in the beginning, basically free from the banks. Like you pointed out, that the banks get it first. One of the things I always said in Time of the Vulture, I said, the farther you are away from the fountain of credit, the worse off you are. And this is why Antal was so uptight about what the boys at the top were doing. When Antal started writing, he was a professor on a retirement salary. All right. Yeah. He had done his thing. He wasn't a speculator. He wasn't an investor.
Wasn't much they could do about him at that point, right?
Yeah. Well, what happened was he got pissed off at Barrick because he had taken his money and invested in Barrick because he knew, he understood the system. He had read Mises. He knew we're going to the shitter. And he knew the value of gold. So he took all his money that he had loose and invested in Barrick Gold Mines, the largest gold mining company in the world.
Deep state company, but yeah.
Oh, George Bush was chairman of the board in the 90s. You know, ex-head of the CIA, about to be president of the United States, was head of Barrick Gold. Barrick had gone from some obscure little Canadian company to the largest gold mining company in the world after having not mined a damn thing. All right. So Antal, who saw his pension, when he realized that Barrick was forward selling gold at below price what they were selling for now, he couldn't believe it. Why would you sell gold futures and deliver it at a lower price? And in an obscure paper that I read by Antal, because I was so close to him, I remember him saying, and Antal was not a conspiracy theorist. All right.
No, not at all.
He and I didn't agree on what they were doing to us. All right. He because he had higher values and really was a pure heart than me. You know, he saw the better part of people. All right. And in fact, sometimes he saw what wasn't there. All right. I always had the advantage of seeing their worst motive. All right. And Antal and I disagreed about conspiracy things. But what Antal said was this: the only reason that Barrick would sell any gold mining company would sell futures at a lower price than the present, than they're selling, is money laundering of gold. Mm-hmm. And I read another paper, Kerry, that basically said Barrick washed the gold of the Yamashita gold that was discovered in the Philippines that the CIA had found. Huge stash of gold in the 90s and cleaned it up. So here we are.
You know, the whole COMEX, CRIMEX, you know, it looked like it was going to go like a summer ago. And then they pulled it out. And out of nowhere, You know, it's back and
look. Listen, it's like we're in the waiting room. Uncle Sam has been in ICU for 20 years. All right. Now, the ones of us who are like who have some, we've read a bunch of, we know the underlying disease that Sam, that our uncle has. All right. And so, in fact, we've sort of bet on his demise. All right. I mean, we're not telling the
room too early.
Yeah. But he keeps coming back. I mean, sometimes it's a fake tan. They wheel him out. He waves at us. You know, he'll speak to us through the room. You know, but I mean, Carrie, when in the 1990s, when I started studying this crap, all right, and I must have been a terrible parent because my kids are just starting their life. All right. I mean, they're in their 20s at the time. All right. Late teens, 20s, high school, college. And, you know, you want the world to be the way you want it to be. And there's dad raving and bitching that we're going to sink, that this is it, that this is it.
Your kids right? Know my kids. I think they're friends.
Yeah, right. And here you and I are.
They're friends.
Yeah. We're sitting there, they're saying, oh, we ought to do this. And we're going, there's no future. Yeah. Yeah. We're headed towards the wall. All right. And Benjamin, who went to MIT, he read what I said. And he listened to it. Right. But he didn't give a damn about economics, but he wasn't dumb. And he said something I never forgot, Carrie, back in the late 90s. He said, you know, Dad, you may be right, but they've got stuff up their sleeve that you don't know about, and it's a really long sleeve. And he was right.
It's a really long sleeve. Looks like it's frayed at the end now and might be about to detach from the shirt.
About it. You're right. But, you know, the goddamn thing may have a life of its own. One of those animals that you chop up is like a chicken.
Yeah.
The economy may be like a chicken that has already lost his head, and yet it's going, quack, 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 and people are still betting on its direction.
Yeah, well, if you ever watch South Park, they had a great one where they show a Wall Street hedge fund. I'm not going to go into the run-up to it, but this kid is there because his father's margarita maker has been securitized, and he wants a refund so that he can reliquify South Park. And when he gets up there, what they're doing is they have like a Wheel of Fortune there, and they take a chicken and they cut its head off, and then they watch where the body winds up, and that's what they do. Right?
That's it. That was my joke, that they're betting on where the chicken's going to, the direction it's going to take.
Exactly. Exactly. That's called life imitating South Park.
As right? It is. As it's doing.
Yeah, it totally is.
But there was a joke I'm sort of afraid of. I hope it doesn't become true. I don't remember the South Park episode where they went to heaven and they saw who was there and came back and he said it was all full of Mormons. Only Mormons were in heaven.
Oh my God. Well, you know what Will Rogers used to say, ignorance got us into this mess and ignorance will get us out, right?
I love that. That's the most optimistic thing I've heard.
Yeah, well, when in doubt, laugh. That's what I say.
Yeah, that's it. That's
when you're laughing, they can't bring you down. You know, the dopamine's flowing and they're not inside your head. They're not dominating that real estate between your ears. And that's really, to me, the most important thing about how you deal with what's happening now.
Don't just survive. Thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Osino Resources is a Ross Beatty-backed gold exploration company in mining-friendly Namibia. Osino's district-scale land package is situated near two producing gold mines, one of which Osino's management team previously developed and sold to B2 Gold. Osino's founders and management are experienced mining professionals who have already successfully developed and sold two companies in the past 7 years. Osino has a tight share structure, and with its current treasury, it can self-fund the advancement of its gold discovery into at least 2022. This is an exploration company with drills turning that you'll definitely want to pay attention to. Osino trades in New York under the ticker OSIIF and in Toronto under the ticker OSI. To learn more, go to osinoresources.com. That's osinoresources.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
You know, Carrie, to bring up Don Juan, that was one of the things he also said. He told Carlos Castaneda, he said, laugh, Carlos. Laugh.
Hey, if you're laughing, you know, the other thing I find works really well is dance. If you're dancing, nobody's screwing with your head.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to watch the news and dance at the same
time. You're right. It's like laughing during sex. You can, the two are admissible. Yeah. It doesn't work.
Well, I've had a few comedy that I won't get into here. But yes, agreed. It is harder.
Good. I want to go to your comedy club when you do that on stand up.
I'm going to
talk about that when you tell that story.
I'm going to. And so getting back to it. So right now they're still knocking gold down, gold shares, everything.
Absolutely.
It's a mess. But that is about to change, isn't it?
Harry, you know, when I did my study on markets and money, what I realized was very early on, and this is where I really diverged from Antal, because it was one of the things that I really saw happen, because I saw everything in terms of power. That was my background, political science. I was intuitively looking at power, all right? Mm-hmm. And what happened is that in when they took gold out of, when they removed the gold back into the U.S. dollar in 1972, gold was at $35 an ounce everywhere, okay? 10 years later, 9 years later, gold was at 850. 850, it went 35 to 850. All right. And on its way up, because it destabilized the dollar. All right. Just destabilized it. So the dollar starts going up, way up in price. And they nothing they could do to end it. And then what happened is that when Volcker, who had okayed, everybody looks at Volcker as the hero, you know, the guy who came in and put out the fire. Well, people don't realize that Volcker was the one who helped light the fire in the first place. He flamed it, you know? You know, he was a political guy, you know, assistant secretary of the treasurer under Nixon. And Friedman had told Nixon, hey, just cut it loose. It's like, that's where the left and the right were the same here. Keynesians and the Friedmanites both agreed that gold was bullshit. All right. Because they were in love with fiat money and what it could do. It's like magic. I mean, this shit's magic until it becomes a virus. All right. And so Volcker was looking at it, and he asked John Exter, who was brilliant central banker. I mean, he grew up during the Depression, all right? And in the 1960s, he put all his money into, took it out and bought gold. In the 60s, all right? Well, in 1971, Volcker comes to Exter, because he's the grand old man of central banking, right, and tells him what he's up against. And Exter said he advised Volcker to revalue the dollar, okay? To devalue the dollar against gold. All right. That'll stabilize.
That made the most sense.
It made the most sense in the world that he lived in. Volcker lived in two worlds. One world was the world that made sense economically. The other world was the world that made sense politically. All right. And Exter looked at him. He said, well, you know, I think you're right. But he said, I won't be able to get that one done. And a month later, a bridge too far. They could see it, and it was the only salvation they had, all right? But he cut the cord in 1971, and what happened is the economy starts destabilizing, inflating, and gold skyrocketed. Well, what happened in the early 80s, and Volcker admitted this, he said, basically, gold became like a barometer of systemic distress. It's like the thermometer that we have if you have a fever, all right? It measures, or white cells, T cells or whatever. There's indicators in the body that tell doctors when something's going really wrong. All right. Well, the price of gold did that because inflation went out of control. Gold skyrocketed, and the central bankers also knew that in the 1930s when the problem wasn't inflation but it was a hyperdeflation, that gold also skyrocketed. Not in terms of price, because it was controlled by the government and you couldn't own it by the government, but the shares of gold of Homestake Mining, the largest mining company in the world, which is a proxy for real gold, skyrocketed, all right? If 10%, one of the things that James Dines said that always made an impression on me, in 1930, you had 10% of your portfolio in Homestake Mining. At the depths of the Great Depression, 1938, you would have been flat. Everything else would have gone to shit, but the shares of Homestake Mining would have gone up so far in dividends and in price that it was a wash, all right? So both inflation and in deflation, gold got you through. Now, the central bankers, because they're playing for the survival of their game, because they have an advantage out of the front gate that nobody else has.
So their whole future is at stake on it. What they did was this. They realized that gold was like a barometer that people could read. And when they got scared, what if you're afraid of your survival and there is an option on the table not only to survive, but to prosper spectacularly? What the hell? You'd be a fool not to do it. And they knew this provided this gold was the thing that made it easy for them to do. So they immediately they started manipulating the price of gold with gold futures. And what I want to say here is that they not only manipulate gold and silver, they manipulate the mining stocks.
Anything
that makes it, you know, it's because why? Because not all games are equal. All right. Now, the boys in charge of the economy, the most important game is the stability of their Ponzi system. You know, we talk about it's very obvious to us about the Chinese Communist Party. All right. It's obvious because culturally we know that the most important thing to the leaders in Communist China is social stability. They're scared shitless of the chickens on the farm losing their heads and going and taking them down, because when they do it in China, it's big time. All right. So they're obsessed with social stability. In the U.S., it's not social stability that the people at the top are obsessed with. It's the ongoing scheme of debt-based money, all right, of the stability of their markets. Because if that happens, then everybody gets scared. Everybody, and so what they've done is they fixed it so gold doesn't move. When you brought up the thing about gold going down, you know, and I read this morning that it may go drop another 10%. One of the things that I study, because I've watched this for 20 years. I'm basically cross-eyed, and I don't look at it anymore because I know who the players are, and I know what they're going to do. But I am surprised every once in a while. But so when I knew that gold was getting beat, I knew why. Because at every time there was in 2008, when the markets went south because of the collapse of the subprime bubble, gold dropped. Carry
right.
Gold dropped, yes. And it dropped because the U.S. got Switzerland, which held 28,000 tons of gold, to dump their gold on the market. Dump it, boom! Now the Swiss love gold, yeah. Right? They love it, like, and they had a huge stash, all right. And they could do it without. If we did it, we'd have to tell the Congress, because that's the way the government has to do it, or at least lie to them. But in Switzerland, they could just do it, and they got the Swiss to do it. Why? And the Swiss love gold because the Swiss, who are in charge of the gold stash, love power. And what they had done was they had bought off the Swiss by establishing the BIS in Switzerland, all right, in the 1940s, 1950s, which is, you know, it's like Lord of the Rings. It's the ring that holds all the other rings in control. Power. Carol Quigley, in his book, Destiny, extraordinary book. He was a professor at Georgetown. And he basically said that central banking was a device by the governments to control the world. And when he wrote the book, he thought that was a good thing, because the only opposite to that was the communists. And they're pretty, you know, they'll do shit, all right? So Quigley absolutely believed that there was a foundation for this stability and this control. By the end of his life, he had rethought the matter and thought, no, there is a danger to this that they're going to do in their own way. And they're gonna survive the communist system because they've got a longer time span of the game, but their intent is selfish. Their intent is not stability. It's only stability that benefits them.
Total exploitative
system. Total exploitative. Absolutely. Totally.
It's there to, and you know, how few people even comprehend any of this, Darryl. Thanks to LBJ saying, let's dumb down the schools so we don't have all these mass protests.
The riot against the Vietnam War. It was led by the college students. That was it. Yeah. Screw, you know, just never let again. Anybody into school. Dilute it.
We don't have to worry about them now because they're too worried about everything PC, right? And everything,
To me, all this crisis going on, and I tell you, Carrie, talking about mental health, I remember in 2007, I had just started writing articles. All right, you know, so I was out there 2008. All right, I'm at a financial conference in San Diego. There's a lot of rich people in San Diego. All right, sure. And I'm at a big country club. All right, and this. I'm not going to mention their name, but they're one of the people that post that are newsworthy, but gold and silver, you know, they've been in this for 20 years. And, you know, and so the people who understood dynamics, who are rich, follow these people. And they were posting my articles
for a long time until they realized how crazy I was. And they stopped posting me. All right. But they certainly loved me in the beginning. And I'm at this buffet. All right. And so, you know, I'm eating, you know, and we're sort of introducing each other. And this guy, he looks at me, he goes, "So you're Daryl Shoon, the guy who writes those articles?" And I go, "Yeah." He says, How can you live? He said, "My doctor told me to stop reading that stuff. He said, it's going to kill me. You know, it's going to kill me. All right. Because it's so dire." Well, you know, he's not the first person who told me that. All right. One of my friends, we were hippies together. I mean, hippies in the 60s. All right. That's hippies. He became a multi-million bank in real. I mean, hundreds of thousands of millions. All right. And he died. All right. And, you know, we hadn't talked in a few years. And he comes by to see me in Tucson there in around 2004. And he asked me what I'm doing. And I've been thinking about this stuff for years. And he got up the next day and he said essentially the same thing. How can you live with yourself? Because, you know, I didn't have his wealth and it wasn't going to affect me. But I was only doing it because I was writing what I saw, what I understood from a perspective. You know, I mean, I knew a whole lot and he didn't like what I was saying and flipped out. And the truth is, we are seeing, and you and I, Carrie, have been talking about this stuff for years. I mean, to have read Human Action is, I mean, I would say to have actually read the book, as you pointed out, off-quoted, rarely read, all right, put you in a category that I put Antal as far as reading Adam Smith, Ricardo, Menger, you know, von Mises. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, including myself, quote these people like we read them. And we didn't. I'm a guy who likes reading the flyleaf of covers. You know, as Martha said, I'm an expert in reading the back of a book and coming to a judgment about it. All right.
Well, just to tell you a little funny thing about the back of the book, Robert Ian taught me this. When you write a book, what you want to do is have 10 questions on the back, because when you send that book out, the host of the TV show or radio show is never going to even open it up. He's going to 5 minutes before your interview, he's going to pick it up and he's going to look at the back.
Yeah.
And he's going to see those questions and he's going to sound like a genius because you wrote them.
Right. And he's going to ask you important questions that you put on the back of your book. Yeah. You're absolutely right. But see, this is why this interview is really has the virtue that it has. All right. I think both you and I, Carrie, know that we're preaching to the choir. All right. And some of that choir is really smart. And other parts of the choir just happen to be passing by and they can carry a tune and, you know, and they dropped in and they've joined their voices. All right. But we're basically preaching to the choir. All right. And we know that people watching this, so we're talking to the choir. But what I do want to say is that you and I have been at this for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that even gold, that gold's going down at the end. To me, gold is, it's not an investment per se that you can take advantage of and go. You can. It's like your house. All right. You can sell at the right time or your Tesla. You know, that's how the market is. It goes up and down. To me, ultimately, gold is a manipulated market, which price is held in check by the boys who don't want it to go really up because it makes things look really bad. So they're going to hold it all the way until their fingers are pried off of it. And at that point, Uncle Sam is not coming out of the ICU. They pull the curtains on the recovery room so you can't look in. But gold really is more than investment. It's a life insurance policy with a death payout on the class of fiat money.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, Daryl, always appreciate you coming on. So, hey, I'm going to try one last question. I'm going to try to pin you down on a time frame for all this.
I say that because that's the diciest of it. I say on the outside, 3 years. But I've been wrong before on timing, not in the general sense. And sometimes I'm really lucky. You know, when I started writing, Carrie, and I always knew it was luck when I predicted the collapse. I'd been seeing that collapse for years, and yet I wrote my book 1 year before it happened. My first article was in May 2007, and I said, this summer, the collapse of subprime is coming home. We're going to see, and in July, two Bear Stearns hedge funds collapsed because of subprime. So I've been really, really lucky about my prediction. So, but I'm qualifying it saying, because you and I both see things before they happen,
All right. Both you and I know that you really can't put your finger on it because it's a moving target. And that's why you asked me that goddamn question at the time, because you know that. All right. Yeah. But in the abeyance of that, that you can't put your finger on it, I'm saying in the next 3 years, we're going to see it culminate.
Okay. I think that's a reasonable assessment. It could be tomorrow, but unlikely. I think what's really going to trigger it, besides this food shortage thing, which obviously they want us to eat crickets. that's their goal here. But besides that, I think that they'll keep it going until there's a natural disaster that
they can't deal with
vital link. And at that point, it's all over. And then history is good because they'll say, well, everything was great until whatever happened, until California fell in, or the Three Gorges Dam in China collapsed.
That's right.
Or, you know, Europe sank into the ocean. But it was all good until then. Everything until was then. Fine. And but this is a case where maybe the losers won't be allowed to write history. We can only hope. drschoon.com. That's drschoon.com. The link is in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. If you've got a question for Daryl, shoot me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. And of course, sign up for your free newsletter. Daryl, always a pleasure. Can't get enough of your work. Thanks.
Thank you, Kerry.
Thanks for listening to Kerry Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.